just thinking it feels a little warm. I know it can't be too warm because Jennifer Huffman still has her sweater in place. Normally by this time, February? Normally Jennifer is wearing like t-shirts and shorts and things like, you know. I was amazed yesterday. We went and do some shopping like we normally do on Saturday. And I saw people out, like what was the high temperature, like 28 yesterday or something like that? And I saw people out and their kids had on sweaters and they're walking around in like shorts and t-shirts. And I thought, man, I can't even fathom that. Like, I mean, I'm grateful that the sun is out, but it's not warm enough for that. But it is a little warm in here today, and I'm grateful for indoor heat. I will never take it quite for granted. Friend of mine who, you know, we were talking about Texas and how they're going through that cold snap. A good friend of mine, she actually moved to Texas thinking that she was getting away from Ohio, which is where we were from. And she's like, you know, this has got to stop. Because, you know, when she originally, we were talking about when we moved to Georgia thinking it would be warmer. And it was warmer, only because winters kind of went a little bit shorter. But, you know, we had these little cold snaps. And these cold snaps are happening more and more. And they're, you know, we should never take for granted the conveniences we have that we're warm. You know, we should always be praying for and considering those people who, you know, maybe they're homeless. Maybe they struggle to find these comforts that we take for granted. So with that, I want to continue where we left off last week. We've been talking about being called out for Christ, but more specifically, we've been talking about culture. We've not only been talking about this on Wednesday during our devotionals and dealing with our culture here as a congregation at the Dover Church of Christ, but just dealing with church culture in general and understand, you know, the church is not just this organization or this group. You know, it's not just the body in the general sense, but it's made up of people, right? So when we talk about church culture, when we talk about healthy church culture, a church culture that promotes and builds the way that God would want it to be built, we're actually talking about a collection of people. Because culture is not just an idea. It's not just a concept. It's not just a bunch of rules and values that we all claim to adopt, but it's what you do. And so one of the aspects I want to talk about today, and it was interesting. This morning I told my wife, I said, yeah, I expect it to be a little bit quiet today because we're going to talk about everybody's favorite topic, sin. More specifically, though, we're going to talk about the church culture that so many of us just kind of maybe overlook or never really think about, but it affects not only how we interact with one another when it comes to sin, but more specifically, it affects why it is that the message of Christ, the gospel, doesn't even seem to be as appealing. Why is it that more people don't respond to the gospel when it is brought to them? Why are people so cynical when you start talking about church? And a lot of it has to do with the culture that we display by our actions, more so than what we claim to value and what we say. And I'm talking about shame. And, you know, it was interesting because even in the response that my wife gave, because I told her, yeah, we're going to talk about shame, she just kind of said, nah, you know, no big deal. But part of that is because in our marriage and in our relationship with one another and our family and how we get along and how we discuss things, it's really not that big a topic in the Craig household. Because part of the culture is there are certain things that we do not shame. And I want to be a little more specific and really see how it is that we can affect change, not only in other people, but also, quite frankly, in ourselves. How we feel like we sometimes don't measure up. How internally we go through these battles and we have these conflicts because of how we view shame. Because of how we approach shame. Because how other people see us handle shame. Title I've given the lesson today is Low Down, Dirty Shame. Low Down, Dirty Shame. Because we think about shame. You know, it's interesting, and I don't want to get too far off into the words and everything, but we've been talking about this culture thing, and very often when people think of shame, they think of something that's negative. They think of something that's associated with things that are dirty. And one of the words that often gets associated with shame is the word guilt. It's not necessarily that it's directly synonymous, but very often we compile these things together. And it was interesting, I was reading a study, and there are other studies that talk about this, but I was reading a study where it talked about how guilt and shame are often coupled together, and in reality, there's another word that is more appropriate, or more appropriately coupled, should be more appropriately coupled with shame, but we often do not make the connection. I'll get into that word in just a second. By the way, I've been studying out culture, and in this book I've read, I just finished it, it's called What You Do Is Who You Are by Ben Horowitz. Thank you, Andrew. I waited for Andrew long enough, and I just decided, you know what? I'm not going to put this responsibility on Andrew to tell me the title of the book that I'm reading. So I said, I'll give myself a reminder. And it's got Ben Horowitz wrote this book. He talks about this in the context of corporate culture, but he's drawing all of these allegories and examples from other popular, well-known things throughout history and other popular cultures where a lot of times we say that we believe something. We've adopted a philosophy. We write these things down. We speak them. We rehearse them. We memorize them. But what we do is actually what determines our actual culture. You think about here at the Dover Church of Christ. You know, we know that our doctrine and what we believe and what we espouse and what we claim is right there on the paper. It's right there in black and white. And we adhere to this idea that you don't add to it and that you don't bring in a bunch of your beliefs and doctrines and your systems and your traditions, that we go strictly by the Bible because that's what we see represented in Christ's church as we read through the scriptures. And yet, when we think about culture, we have to ask ourselves, is that actually what we do? I want to look at some examples of shame, but you know, we're talking about this word guilt. And there's a distinction, it's a little bit of a fine distinction, but it matters. When we think about shame, very often the word shame is something that is associated with who I am. Whereas oftentimes guilt is something that we associate with something that we did. So for an example, okay? If I go out here and I hit somebody in a car accident and I destroy their car, I am guilty and I may even feel remorse because it was my fault. But I don't think of myself from a shameful perspective in the sense that I am a horrible driver. After all, I wasn't drunk. I wasn't doing anything intentionally reckless or careless. Whereas a person who is an alcoholic, who always consistently gets behind the wheel taking chances, they may associate shame with their behavior because they know that this is a part of their regular pattern. And so this idea of shame and guilt, very often we can make the distinction. I can feel guilty for something, but I may not bear shame on an extended basis because I don't associate with that being who I am. Now, the thing about it is, though, there are certain things that, frankly, we do associate with who we are because we all know that we are not perfect. We all know that we have some, we'll just call them bad habits. We have things that maybe we have tried to overcome. I'm reminded of, you know, Paul talking about that thorn in his flesh where he just couldn't quite get over. We're going to get to that here in a second. But it's important that we put this in context because I want to look at some examples, some examples of shame, but not from the traditional perspective. Because sometimes we don't think of ourselves as being shameful or shame worthy, or we don't see ourselves as projecting shame on other people. We frankly don't even think of it as being a toxic thing because we very often don't use the word shame. It doesn't just pop up in our head. But all of us are affected by shame culture. All of us live and are the way that we behave, the way we talk to one another, places we go, places we avoid. Very often, it's a result of shame or avoiding shame, not wanting to be shamed. And when we think about how it is that we are to be the Christians that God wants us to be, the representatives that God wants us to be as his ambassadors, we have to tackle shame culture. Otherwise, his word cannot get through. I want to start by looking at an example in Mark chapter 5. A very familiar example that many of us know. Starting in verse 21, it says, when Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders, named Jairus, came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, my little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live. So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once Jesus realized that power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, who touched my clothes? You see the people crowding against you? His disciples answered, and yet you can ask, who touched me? But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. We see this example of this woman who had this bleeding condition. She was hemorrhaging, right? And this had gone on for 12 years. And you think, well, 12 years is a very long time. You know, I don't know. It says she ran out of money. She spent everything she had. She gave everything she had to get away from this. And it wasn't, see, it's important that we understand the context of this. This wasn't just about the anemia and the weakness and the pain that come from the hemorrhaging, but it's also the shame and the stigma that's associated with it. See, they had very strict customs and laws and rules about women who were bleeding, that you were to be outside. If you go back and you look at the law of Moses and they talk, God was very specific. If a woman is bleeding, that she's to be outside of the camp and these types of things. And, you know, on the surface, it can look like, well, yeah, but that's because, you know, we just don't want disease. We just don't want it to, you know, some people maybe even thought it was contagious. And this is not just something that this woman experienced with bleeding. We find the same through line, the same consistency when you look at lepers. And the fact that these lepers were to be held away from other people, that they were not to associate with the rest of the community. You know, we may think to ourselves, well, yeah, but maybe they thought it was, they could be contaminated or something. And that's possible. But in reality, it was more than just that. It was more than just, I'm afraid that it's contagious. It was more than just, for somebody who was demon-possessed, I'm afraid they're going to attack me or, oh, it's going to get on me. It was more than that. But just to focus here, we see the desperation that this woman had. I know that I bear this disease. It is painful. It has been a struggle. I have no more money. The doctors can't help me. My own family can't associate with me. And the shame that comes with it because everybody knows. And yet we see that in that desperation, in that pain, in that hurt, in that shame, she went to the right place. She went to get healing, a place where we would expect anybody that wants to be healed from that shame. You think about it, well, and we saw this in the example. We don't have time to go through all the examples, but we see this example where the man who was born blind, they said, why is this person born blind? Were they born blind because of something, you know, were they blind because of something they did, or is it something that the father did, or what is the cause of this? How did this happen? Very often, we associate people's struggles and their problems and their diseases. We want to know, is this person broke and struggling and without resources and without a home and without a family? Is it because they have an addiction? Is it because of something they did? Is it because they're a criminal? Or is it because they were the victim? Is it because of something that's no fault of their own? And even if we don't do this consciously, subconsciously, we want to associate a cause to this effect. We want to determine whether or not this person is worthy of our compassion or our pity, or whether or not maybe they kind of deserve it. Now, I heard someone speak about this one time, and they were like, well, you know, maybe people would have looked at it differently. Maybe they knew that she was promiscuous. And so in their mind, it's like, well, we're kind of okay with the fact that she is suffering in anguish and shame, not able to feel the love and warmth and the bonding of being a part of the community because she deserved it because of her lifestyle. And we go that far, but sometimes we don't go back far enough to ask, well, how did she get there in the first place? Whether it was her fault, whether she did things to cause this and bring this on herself or not. The man who's blind, whether it was because of his sin or his father or mother or whoever else. Sometimes we get so caught up in the causation that we lose sight of Jesus in this moment, where he says, regardless of what you think of the reason, regardless of the fact that this woman had no business being in this crowd, Jesus was determined to identify who did it for one reason. He wanted to put on full display both this woman's faith and also put on full display God's grace. As a church, as his ambassadors, do we put God's grace on full display? Is that our larger concern, or are we more caught up with the shame that we might have by associating with somebody this way? We sometimes forget that Jesus being a Jew, that it was taboo and it was considered a breach of the law for him to even touch somebody who was considered unclean. But that wasn't his concern. His concern was this woman's faith and the grace that God is willing to give to those who are suffering. No matter the source, shame is a tool used to cripple us that God's grace seeks to overcome. Shame is very crippling. It prohibits us. It limits us. It stops us from feeling like we can be worthy. It stops us from feeling like we can be loved. It prevents us from opening up and getting help. When we look and it talks about how in the New Testament, where it talks about how you go and you confess your sins one to another so that you may be healed, that you go and you seek out the prayers of the righteous who are powerful and effective. But shame cripples us. It makes us feel like we're unworthy. We will be outcasted. Yes, I want to get better, but I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to open up about it. I don't want to share this thing because I don't want to lose my job. I don't want to lose the respect that I have. I don't want people to break away from me. As a church, part of the culture that we have to adopt is a church that seeks to promote God's grace. You know, I was talking about the word. We associate guilt with shame very easily and very seamlessly. But during this study, they were saying actually the word that should be most associated with what we know of as shame is this girl right here. Anybody know who this is? Anybody ever seen the movie Inside Out? My daughter's raising her hand. Yes, that's disgust. Disgust! And so in the movie Inside Out, this little girl, she's learning her emotions and she's developing a more broad understanding of who she is on the inside. And disgust, you know, they kind of, you know, she was kind of snarky and like everything disgusts me, right? You know, and I thought about this because we think about disgust, and I'll tie this together here in just a minute, but I was thinking about, when you think of disgust, those of you who maybe you're like, I've never seen the movie Inside Out. But you don't have to see the movie Inside Out to appreciate the sentiment in the word disgust. I was thinking of Linda. Linda is one of those people, Linda Hill. She's one of those people where her face says it all, right? Even with her mask on right now, I can tell what she's thinking right now. Her eyes are very descriptive, right? And you see this face, you don't know what he drank. You don't know what it tastes like. You don't know who handed it to him. You don't know how long it's been sitting. Is it warm? Is it cold? It doesn't matter. Here's what you do know by looking at his face. He is disgusted, right? This one especially. Like, this is like somewhere between disgust and stank face. Like, I just, ugh. Like, and we look at this and we think of this and, you know, this is kind of comical. You know, it's a little funny because we've all made this face before. You know, you smell something terrible. You see something terrible. But this is what happens with shame. Very often we tell ourselves, you know, that common little statement, that phrase that we all have heard or we've made it where it's like, hey, you know, you hate the sin, but not the sinner. This is what Jesus was dealing with. There was a lot of people who knew that the law and what they were supposed to be doing was hating the sin and not the sinner. And they may have even believed that. But what their face said, what their action said, how they behaved towards one another was, you disgust me. Your sin doesn't just disgust me, you do. I remember when Joseph was here and he was, you know, Joseph over in India, how his ministry, I remember he was saying, he said, you know, the reason why they kept lepers out was not just because people were not intelligent enough and didn't know enough about medicine and science that they thought that being around somebody with leprosy, that they were going to get it. No, it was disgust. The smell of people with leprosy was disgusting. He said, it is still disgusting. He invited me over. I'm still trying to figure out a time when I can get over there to visit. He wants me to come for a few weeks. And one of the things he was saying was, he said, when you do, he said, I've talked to a lot of people. He said, but I know that you would handle it well. He said, because frankly, there are some people who they would not be able to come and treat people with dignity in my ministry. They're loving people. They're kind people. They're very generous people. They've helped our ministry. But when they come, it's not a matter of just coming and showing up in your piety and in your superiority. There are going to be some things that will disgust you. A woman who's bleeding, who has a bleeding disorder. It wasn't just, okay, well, maybe she's done something sinful. No, a woman who is constantly hemorrhaging, she smells bad. She's dirty. You see the same thing with blind people who can't be associated with other people. Who's helping them bathe? How are they getting a toothbrush? See, it's the disgust. And a lot of times when people come to Jesus, they know that they need Jesus, just like this bleeding woman. There's people who walk through these doors. They know that they need to have a relationship with God. And it's not just, do we have a welcome door and are we greeting them? And are we going to, you know, say welcome and thank you for being here? But do you have a disgusted look on your face? Do you project disgust because you know the lifestyle that they live? Let's face it, some people don't hide it as well. And they're, you know, because it's obvious. They come in and they smell bad. They're not well kept. They don't have any money. They don't have any opportunities. You know, I think of the woman at the well, and as she approaches and she's having this conversation with Jesus, sometimes we can forget the shame that is associated, the stigma even back then, with you've been married 5 times and everybody in your town knows it. We think, oh, well, Jesus was so clairvoyant. No, it wasn't just that Jesus was clairvoyant, but everybody knew that this woman had been married 5 times and that the man she was with was not her husband. The stigma, the shame that comes with that, the stench that comes with that. And we have to ask ourselves, we know we're all sinful. We know we all make mistakes, but do we get disgusted just with the sin? Or are we disgusted with the people? We talked about this during the whole coronavirus and the masking, and there was all this politics around it. But the fact of the matter is, in an honest moment, some of us were disgusted with each other. Not the sin. Not the fact that this person had a shortcoming, they didn't understand it. We're disgusted with people who voted for the liberals on the left and Joe Biden because how could you support somebody who believes in a woman's right to choose an abortion and all life is sacred? Or then you're disgusted with somebody, how could you support Trump? See, we don't use the word shame and use the word disgust, but then we wonder why it is we can't talk freely and open up. Because nobody wants to have to deal with that shame. It'd be nice if we could all quietly sneak up behind Jesus and touch him and get healed. Some of us don't want to talk about our personal sins and things that we desperately, for years and decades, have wanted to deal with and overcome, and we haven't gotten healing. But we're too ashamed. Because even though no one's ever said, I'm disgusted with you, we know that people who we are supposed to trust in a church where we're supposed to love one another, where we're supposed to support one another, where we're supposed to be here to pray for and with one another, we know that our brother or our sister is repulsed by who we are. And so we bear the same shame that so many other people, because we know that people are disgusted. And this is a part of the culture that limits us from being able to not only help one another, but to reach those who do not know who Christ is. I want to continue in the story because it's a very important part of this that sometimes gets overlooked when we talk about shame and shame culture. Starting in verse 35 of Mark chapter 5, it says, while Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. Your daughter is dead, they said. Why bother the teacher anymore? Overhearing what they said, Jesus told them, don't be afraid, just believe. He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep. But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, Talitha, kum, which means, little girl, I say to you, get up. Immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. Not sure if this is a coincidence or if this was a part of some divine plan, or maybe there's just something I haven't exegeted the text enough to know and understand. But I find it fascinating that this little girl was 12 years old. And along the way, on his way to this house to bring her back, he heals a woman who had been enduring and suffering with this bleeding disorder, this hemorrhaging, for the exact same amount of time that this girl was alive. But more to the point here, we see something that's very important about the way that people responded to Jesus. It says, hey, you know, don't worry about it. It's going to be okay. I got this. People actually laughed. Not like in a chuckle kind of tongue-in-cheek way. No, they were literally like mocking, like scoffing, like, oh my goodness. Like, who do you think you are? Like, you're just going to bring somebody back from the dead? Jesus is like, yes. Yes, I am. But it wasn't just laughing at Jesus, but let's face it, sometimes in our Christian walk, we get that same shame response where people mock us and laugh at us and dismiss us because of the faith that we have. Things that they have given up on. They laugh at you and shame you for not giving up on it. You haven't given up on your son. You haven't given up on your spouse. You haven't given up on your mom. You haven't given up on your best friend. You haven't given up on your marriage. You haven't given up on a relationship. You haven't given up. You believe that Jesus is still going to come through. And people like to bully us and shame us in our faith. We see here that Jesus agreed to do something. He told Jairus, yes, I'm going to do this. I'm going to walk with you. But along the way, he did some things. You got to imagine, well, what is Jairus thinking? Well, maybe he's not going to come through for me. Because while he was over here searching around, trying to figure out who this person was that touched him, because he felt that faith. He felt that spirit move. He felt that jolt. He wants to know who this is so I can highlight this. And the report now is that, hey, she's dead. You can't bring her back. As Christians, we have to resist that temptation. We have to resist the pressure. We have to be a church that cultivates and builds and encourages an attitude that says we don't shame people for their faith. We don't mock people. We don't jeer people. We're not dismissive and cynical about people who are still waiting on God to show up. You say, yeah, but it's been 10 years. It's been 20 years. It's been however long it's been. We're still waiting. We have to encourage people rather than shame them for waiting on God. We can never allow this world to shame us for our faith in Christ, who's always worth the wait. You know, sometimes we look at things and we look at it very binary, like, well, if God were this loving God, I hear this all the time, if God were this loving God, he wouldn't allow this thing to happen in the first place. If God truly loved this woman, why would he allow her to bleed, spend all her money for 12 years? And we completely lose sight of the glory that God received when she was healed. We think of sometimes our own sinful nature, the things that we have a difficult time, that we struggle with. We don't open up about it. We don't talk about it because we frankly don't even want to admit that we live in a society and a culture and even in the church. We allow people to be shamed. We say, yeah, you need to be healed. You need to be forgiven. You need to give up on your sin. But along the way, does God's grace and compassion show? Or only my face that says, you know what? Your sexuality disgusts me. Your promiscuity disgusts me. Your lack of morals, your lack of decorum. Shame is a learned response. And there is appropriate shame. There is appropriate guilt. I gave you the example, like if I hit somebody, yes, I'm guilty. And there's an appropriate amount of shame if I've been irresponsible. But again, going back to that culture thing, it's what you do that makes you who you are. It's what makes the culture here. If we are going to change the culture of the church, where people who need God the most, who don't know him the most, if we're going to be a church that is inviting and brings those people to the cross like we were at one point brought to the cross, not only do we have to be willing to talk about sin and point out where sin needs to be corrected and eradicated and we have to get rid of it, but we have to promote this idea that it's not something that's stinky and something that we're above and you disgust me because of your sin. You know, I was talking about word association, and anybody who spent enough time reading literature and understands words, when you think of a swan, one of the words, first words that comes to mind, there's this game we watch called what's it called on Game Show Network? America Says. Anybody ever watch that? And it's like, you know, America says this and they'll leave out a blank word and then it's like word association. What are the words you put in there? When you think of a swan, the first word, like I put it, I did this, I didn't know this was going to happen, even though I thought this, but one of the first things that comes up is grace. People associate swans as being graceful. You know, it's interesting, the word grace has taken a bit of a turn where we associate the word being graceful with ballerinas and dancers and, you know, Fred Astaire and these people who are, you know, the antonym of that is clumsy and awkward and uncoordinated and those types of things. But we sometimes forget that the etymology comes from the actual word grace. We associate grace as this action or this state of being or this thought, but we don't associate it with a behavior. I was telling you about when Joseph and I were talking. He said, you know, everybody can't be in front of somebody who stinks without their face lighting up and showing them how disgusted they are. Everybody can't, you know, there's this place, it used to be, it's in Cincinnati, it's the health clinic. And it used to be in Avondale on Bernard Avenue. I don't know if it's still there. But it's the place where people go to get checked for like STDs. You know, it's that one particular spot. And it's interesting because people, you know, that this one person I know that used to work there, he told me, people would come in like, hey, man, I think I got a cold. And he was like, look, you don't have to tell me it's a cold. You don't have to tell me that you got a headache. Just tell me what it is. Everybody's in here for the same reason. It's interesting. Sharice's Aunt Martha, she used to work. She's retired now, but she used to work at the health department, and she was the one who would actually give people the news and the results on their different tests, whether it was chlamydia, HIV, whatever, all these things. And what's interesting is people come in and they come in guarded. They come in very, you know, almost guilted and shamed and worried, and they put up these smoke screens. Some people show up big and bold like, you know what, it doesn't matter whether you tell me I have HIV or not. It's not going to affect me. Other people are already crying because everybody has a response to this shame, this guilt. And, her, you know, her aunt, she was like, look, she's like, I'm doing my job. And I understand that everybody in here, she would even say, she said, actually, the best thing you could do is come in here and get tested. At least that way, you know, and you won't go out there and continue to spread it. You can actually fix it. You can work on it. You can do something about it. See, this is important because we don't think of ourselves as being a clinic, but that's what the church should be. A bunch of people that no matter what comes in here, no matter who we see, whether they come in here because they've got a sexual addiction or a drug addiction, or they've got five broken marriages, or they've got a gambling problem, they've got debt, they've come from abuse, no matter what it is, we can be graceful. We can show God's grace in the way that we respond because we're not disgusted with those people. Why? Because those are God's children. No matter what my kids grow up to be, no matter what mistakes they're going to make, I would hope that somebody would show them some grace. I want to be shown that same grace. As a church, do we reflect that grace? I want to finish it here very quickly. 2 Corinthians chapter 12. We all know this passage. Starting in verse 6. Even if I should choose to boast, I would not be a fool because I would be speaking the truth. But I refrain so no one will think more of me than is warranted for what I do or say, or because of these surpassingly great revelations. Therefore, in order to keep me from becoming conceited, I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan, to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. We can't emphasize and embrace this enough. This is so much of what we need to be as a church. If we are ever going to help other people, we have to. And notice he says here, not, yeah, I let people know that I have some weaknesses. No, he says, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses. I delight in these weaknesses. I share with people these weaknesses. Because I don't want anybody to think that somehow, well, you know what? You're more worthy than I am. I can't do what you do. We can all live free of shame. We can all accept the grace of God. Like Paul here, we have to project that. We have to show that that's how you break shame. That's how people stop hiding behind their weaknesses, terrified of being judged, terrified of somebody finding out that they have a weakness, that they have sin. You say, no, I'm going to show you God's grace by how weak I am and how he still uses me, how he still shows up in my life. And I am no more or less a sinner than you are. God's grace is the cure to overcoming a culture of shame and building a church of witnesses. I use that word witnesses there because we have to be witnesses to God's mercy and grace. Not just people who can recite scriptures and tell people the do's and don'ts and the cultural norms and the things that will make us accepted. Not just you can be forgiven if, but God actually wants you, flaws and all. We hide behind this, well, yeah, but as a church, we don't want to condone sinful behavior. We don't want to, you know, give the wrong image where we somehow accept or condone or allow people to live sinful lifestyles. Paul says, no, there are things that I can't help. There are things I will never be able to overcome. I asked God to take it away from me. He said, my grace is sufficient for you. Do we truly believe that God's grace is sufficient for ourselves, for other people? Is that what we project as a church? I want to close with a few questions, a couple of takeaways. Do I project grace among others who have not received and accepted it in their life from Christ? Do I contribute to a turned up nose culture in the church? You know, that turned up nose where it's like, you know, we don't walk around saying, well, I'm better than Andrew. I'm better than Charisse. But the moment that something is revealed, the moment that something about them disgusts you, you turn up your nose. Do we project that we are above people who are sinners, not realizing that that's what's turning them away? That's what's preventing them from coming and being a part of God's family. Do we turn up our nose or do we open our arms? You know, it's interesting when you smell something that's bad or when you taste something that's bad, even the way that you respond to it is a learned behavior. I can tell you firsthand, I go to the gym and there are many smells that I smell at the gym. And it's amazing how when you really don't want to hold your nose, you don't have to. You can just kind of sit there and bear it. You ever notice how when you're by yourself in a private moment that stinky things that come out of your body don't offend you quite as much as if it comes out of someone else's? Because this is the psychology. Like we talked about last week, we think of our intentions and what we meant to do, and we understand all the rationalizations for us, but when it's other people, we know their actions, we know what they did. Do we turn up our nose at people, or do we project grace on them? Do I limit my relationship with God due to a shame response to sin as opposed to an appropriate guilt response? You know, I was talking about this in the very beginning. There is an appropriate time for you to feel a certain sense of shame and remorse. Again, we don't have time, but like if you look at the story of David, he goes out here, he commits adultery, he kills a man trying to cover it up. He had shame. He should have shame. But as you continue down and you see his response, he took it to God. He confessed it. He owned it. There's a difference between a shame response, which keeps us hiding and grabbing fig leaves and trying to disguise ourselves and hide from God, versus an appropriate guilt. I know that I am guilty, therefore I know that I need grace. When you mess up, are you running from the law and fleeing justice, or are you looking for an attorney? Because you know that while I deserve it, I still want clemency. When is the last time I engaged in a shame-free discipleship? Shame-free discipleship. Do I have a relationship where both safety and accountability exist? This is so important. Not only do we need to be these vessels who do these things and put them out there, but ask yourself, do you have a relationship? Do you have multiple relationships with people who you can talk to? I was making fun of Miss Linda and her facial expression, but the fact of the matter is I can trust Miss Linda. I talk to Miss Linda. I open up about very personal and private things that I am afraid of, failures that I make. I talk to her like a mom. I talk to her like somebody I can confide in. But I also know that I'm going to get some accountability. When I talk to Marcos, when I talk to some of you, it's not just you know what? I don't want to let them know that I have weaknesses. I don't want to let them know that I have shortcomings. No, I need them to know. Because not only do I need the accountability, I need discipleship. I need that iron to sharpen some iron. I need to be challenged where I am coming up short. But I also need to know that it is safe. Do people know that you are safe? Do people know that you are not going to be disgusted and turn them away because of who they are? Do people know that you are bringing that compassion and grace that was shown to you by God? Do you have that type of relationship with someone? Are you hiding? Are you running from the accountability that you may desperately want because you're afraid of being shamed? And finally, am I willing to wait on God and trust Him above the pressures, standards, and norms that society places on me every day? Am I willing to wait on God? So often we have to ask ourselves, you know, because we know we should wait on God. We know we should be patient. And we know that 12 years is a long time. There's a lot of doubt and desperation and fear and faithlessness in between day one and year 12. But are we truly imitating this woman who waited and waited, gave everything she had, and when she had nothing else, she had faith because she heard what Jesus did? Along the way, when Jesus says, "Yes, I will," but then he stops to help other people along the way. Are we frustrated? Are we impatient? God, when is my turn? I got here first. I asked you first. Why couldn't you go heal my daughter and then come back and heal this woman? Do we truly trust God enough to wait on him? Do we truly trust him when people are shaming us for our faith in him? Are we willing to let him have his way in everything in our walk with him?